Voices of the Temple, official podcast of the Temple of Witchcraft, exploring mystery and magic through love, will, and wisdom.
All right. Hi, listeners. Before I introduce who we are with, you know what I'm going to do. Let us pray to get into alignment. So take a deep breath and come into the present moment, pulling your energy from the past, pulling your energy from the future and into the present as we call to the Great Spirit. I call to the two who move as one through the three rays of love, will, and wisdom. We call upon the goddess, maiden, mother, and crone, past, present, and future, creator, sustainer, and destroyer, weaver of the web. We call to the God, Lord of light and Lord of darkness, God of the green and the gold, God of the horn and the red, singer of the song. Be with us now and forever, so mote it be.
Mote it be.
So I am here with the wonderful Byron Ballard. Yay!
Yay!
So let us dive into all of my fun questions, because, you know, this podcast is all about interviewing. How do you spiritually identify, and how'd you get there?
Oh, that is such an interesting question. I was raised unchurched in the rural half of my county where I live. And that meant that my mother's family were Methodists. Mm-hmm. In fact, my great-grandfather was a founder of a Methodist church here. But for some reason, my father got into some kind of not so happy with the church moment, and we never went back to church. So I am the rare Appalachian person who was never baptized. I didn't go to church, except sometimes I would spend the weekend with my grandparents and would go with them. So I spent a good amount of time from like the age of 10 onward wondering about concepts of religion. And I fell in love with Greek and Roman mythology, as many, many girls do.
Mm-hmm.
And the question I had was, why is that mythology, but Christianity is religion? And that bothered me for a long time. I mean, frankly, until I was much older and could work out the geopolitical part of that.
Mm-hmm.
So for a long time, I didn't really have any kind of religion, but I had a spirituality. And because I lived in the country, everything was based for me in nature. So storms felt very sacred to me. Snow felt sacred. When the leaves turned glorious in the fall and then fell off, all of that felt very holy and sacred to me. And I was raised by parents who, I guess in the modern day, we would say were neglectful. But I literally would leave in the summer, leave the house in the morning with a peanut butter and jelly sandwich tucked into the bib of my overalls. And then I would go up on the mountain and just be up on the mountain. And there were streams of water there that were clean enough to drink. So I knew I had to be home before dark. And that was the whole of the boundary, is that home before dark. So that placed me in a way to think of that as my home. That whole landscape was my home, and I was at home there, still am at home there. So somewhere in my freshman year in college, I was in an encounter group with a bunch of other women, and we discovered Wicca. And we just thought that was the coolest thing ever. And we all self-initiated. In fact, we did this kind of, now it would be considered an old-fashioned initiation, where we stood with our legs apart, and one by one, we were pulled through the birth canal so that we were reborn. And this would have been about 1975. The The other story of that, and Adam, you know me well enough to know I'm Appalachian, so there's always a backstory and a side story. And so here's the other, the side story of that is that this was the 70s when the legal drinking age was 18. And at my university, they'd have a kegger, there'd be a keg in the student union, there'd be a keg here. So we had all also been drinking beer for our self-initiation. So we would get the giggles as we were being pulled through the birth canal because inevitably somebody would say, "Hurry up, I've got to pee." And the idea that you would be having this sacred solemn ceremony of rededication, and that somebody might actually have had too much beer. So I think that kind of marks my passage into the absurdity and silliness of the religions that I practice. So my training is in an offshoot of McFarland Dianic, which is a mixed gender Dianic group. And so my ordination is in American tribal Wicca, which about eight people in the country actually practice. But here's the truth of it. As I've gotten older, I've realized that what I am is an animist. And when I take away the structure of Wicca and the structure of any other religious settings that I might have been drawn to, the reality for me is that I think that everything is ensouled, everything. So right now, I am sitting in the food pantry of Mother Grove Goddess Temple. And here's the packet, the side pack of ramen, and that has a soul. And the table over here has a soul. And even the hideous carpet has a soul. And that doesn't even begin to touch stones and trees and water and all of that. So when it all boils down, I'm an animist. And that is the foundational piece of my spirituality.
Do you feel that, because I know animism, is the like there's spirit in everything that we can physically touch, taste, smell, whatever. But also, do you go beyond that to there are also spirits that are beyond, that are ineffable, invisible, and also.
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely.
I just
So
want to make it clear because some people will get picky with me
no,
about my animism is. I'm
people
like,
in the pagan and Wiccan community get picky? No, absolutely not. Yeah, so I guess I should have begun that by saying, as I define animism, I am an animist, and here is that definition. And that feels really comfortable to me. But when I'm doing interfaith work, I trot out my Wiccan credentials because that's what I was ordained in a Wiccan ceremony and in a Wiccan tradition. And then I took a second ordination once Mother Grove Goddess Temple was up and our first cohort of priestesses, I was in that cohort too, because it felt important to me that this temple that I was part of the team who founded it, that I also hold the ordination of that. So when I'm doing that kind of interfaith work, which I do more and more of lately, then I'm reverend and I'm ordained. And if they want to know my religion, I will tell them it is Wicca, because that feels tangible to people in the interfaith world. They've heard of Wicca and they've heard of animism, but not necessarily as a religion.
Yeah, more of
And
a
then
philosophy.
it helps me to walk in that world by being able to be credentialed out, as it were.
Ordination is really helpful for some of those things.
It really is. Like when you go to the, I just left pastoral counseling with someone, but the biggest joy, I guess, of being ordained is hospital work, because they don't question that at all. You walk in and you go, "I am so and so's pastor, and I'm here for a pastoral visit," and there's no question. And that chaplaincy piece is really important, as all of us are building community, as you all know, with the work that you do.
Oh, yeah. There's so many parts of the temple that need that to be able to do like the hospice stuff, to do, hospital visits, to do all of it. You kind of need
Wedding,
that.
legal
Weddings,
weddings, yeah.
funerals, wickenings, anything like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you need it. So we sort of dived in a little bit to what is your spiritual origin story. So is there anything else you want to share about that?
I do, and I don't think I'm unique in this, but I separate my magical practice from my spiritual practice, which is a little odd, but I grew up in a Scots-Irish family, and I was told when I was about 9 or 10 that when I became a woman, so at first menses, that I would be given a gift. And I knew it wasn't going to be ruby earrings or a big ruby ring, but it would be something that I knew ran in the family. And some of those things are what used to be called prophetic dreaming, but we think of it now as precognitive dreaming, hands-on healing, second sight, the ability to know what's going on elsewhere without anyone telling you what was going on elsewhere. Well, it's a terribly empathetic series of abilities. My grandmother had she had second sight, but she also had prophetic dreams. And in my study now of my family and other families, I understand that things often skip a generation. So that was the gift that I got when I was 12 at Christmas time. I was given the gift of prophetic dreaming. So there was someone that I could talk to about it. I could talk to my grandmother, and she would explain how the dreams are different than ordinary dreams. That some dreams are just you working through what happened in the workaday world, and those are lovely and they tell you things. And sometimes dreams are things that give you ideas of what you can be and would be. And some dreams are telling you what is going to happen, and you really need to pay attention. So I was fortunate, and a lot of people aren't, to have some instruction in all of that. My mother, though she kept saying it skipped her generation, my mother obviously had the ability to interact with discarnate energy beings. My mother was a ghost hunter. She loved ghost stories. She would hear about a ghost, and sometime that weekend, my dad would load us all up in the station wagon and we'd go to see if we could see the ghost. Well, that didn't feel to her like it was anything very useful. And so she always said she didn't get anything. And frankly, she didn't expect me to get anything either, so that when I did, it was a surprise to her. So my daughter, when she was born, she got the same ability my mother has had. And that was, she can see and communicate with spirit beings. Most of them are beings that were formerly human, but she also has talked to other kinds of spirit beings too. And she does a lot of ancestor work. So I suspect that if she had a daughter or had a child, because it doesn't just happen on the mother line, but in our family, that's how it happened to happen, that her daughter might in fact have what I have, which is the dreams and also the deep attention to nature and the connections of nature. But I also do a lot of spirit work, often inspired by my daughter. So that's the other vein of it, is that that Appalachian folk magic piece was never thought to be particularly religious, because it comes to us from a Protestant Christian tradition. It came right out of Ulster and Scotland, through Pennsylvania, down to the Southern Highlands. And so there's the idea that this is not a skill and ability I have. I am merely a vessel for spirit. And that's how I heard it described again and again. And I don't know that that's not true for me. It just may be that I think of it as a different spirit or a different set of spirits. That was something I had really early on, and that has remained with me my whole life. And so the finding of religion maybe 10 years later, it the religion that I sought or that picked me out was a religion that also worked perfectly well with the family tradition, with the folk tradition that I had also inherited.
Yeah. I feel like that is really a gift to have others in the family who are open to talking about certain things. I know for myself, it got a little crazy because I'm also a dreamer. And I have trouble sometimes because well, we were in New York, walking along, and we're walking down the High Line, and from
Oh, nice.
yeah, so we're walking along, and I go, "Oh, look, there's the little island." Da, da, da. And the boys are like, "What are you talking about?" And I'm like, "We've been there before, haven't we?" And I gave them a whole bunch of information about the little island, and then I was like, "I don't know when I learned that," and couldn't place it. And the boys were like, "Oh, it's another Adam moment, So, but all of the things that I said were correct about it. So it was like, yeah, it was one of those moments. But like that, my family, they didn't talk really about that. The only thing they did was dowsing, but they never talked about it. They were like, "Oh yeah, well, dowsing. We all do that. Like that was a skill everyone had." And I was like, okay. But there is that like search, because like I feel like folk tradition tells us that it's supposed to be passed down through family and these abilities. But when you are, when no one talks about it, you go, where did I get this? Did it come with my spirit? Did it come with my body? Like,
Is it a
what?
DNA thing?
Is it a DNA thing? And like, it sent, I went into an ancestry.com rabbit hole for a while, looking for things. I did find that, surprisingly, my dad's side is descended from accused witches. So that was fun. Was like,
Fun.
great, great.
Nice.
It was a gift of the pandemic. To bring you back to your work with your community, your local community went through, I'll say it, hell, going through the hurricane with Helene and having to recover from that. How is the recovery effort?
It is ongoing. In some places, it has gone remarkably well. In other places, there is still a lot of devastation. We were well served. We, as this community of Western North Carolina, Eastern Tennessee, little bit of Virginia, little bit of Kentucky, little bit of South Carolina, we were served so well by the community itself. And it's important for all of us to remember that in the case of a natural disaster, the first respondents are the people that are affected by the disaster. And we really stepped up. It was wonderful to see. And there was no religion, there was no politics. It was, what do you need? And if we can get that and bring it to you, we will do that. And that went on for many, many months. The election, kind of the politics of that, reared its ugly head sometimes, but mostly it didn't. And if people were in need, then we did our best as a community to make sure those needs were met. It's not, the need is not so great now for the things that we did supply. So initially, no one could get into the area. And the grocery stores were all closed because there was no electricity. And so food was an issue. And water, clean, potable water was an issue. And housing was an issue. Well, n now those things are lessened because the electricity is returned. I personally was without power for 2 weeks,
Wow.
but many people were without power for much, much longer.
Wow.
We did not have potable water coming out of the city water system until almost Thanksgiving. And I will say and have said, I still don't believe the water is potable. When you drink water from the tap, it has a kind of an oily feel to it, and it doesn't taste the way the water used to taste. That being said, we put a filtration system on our kitchen faucet, and then I filter it again through a Brita filter before I ingest it. Even then, I'm a little uncomfortable. So we are slowly coming back. Politically speaking, we have yet to get money that was allocated to the region from our own North Carolina General Assembly, because they are primarily Republicans and they are arguing about all kinds of things. And we have yet to get the money that was allocated by the Biden administration. That's still held up federally. So there are expenses that municipalities and counties have had to just take on when they didn't really have extra magic money. And that's going to be down the road, that's going to be a startling calamity, because it means that property values will have to, the taxes on property will have to shoot up. Property values will have to shoot up because they're going to have to make their money on the back of people who live here through taxes, because that other money was not, the emergency money was not forthcoming. At this point, I doubt we will ever get money from the federal government. If we get money from the state, I will be surprised, but that will be less shocking than the feds. We did have FEMA here for a long time, and FEMA did much good work, but FEMA is a huge federal bureaucracy, and many people simply didn't have the patience to walk through all the steps to get what they needed, even though FEMA had set up at our local mall, had set up a whole storefront full of people at desks who were there for you to come in and say, this is what happened, tell me what I'm eligible to receive. But a lot of people just, they didn't trust FEMA, didn't trust the government. They felt like somehow if they signed paperwork with FEMA that somebody could take their land. There was a lot of misinformation. So it is ongoing. The region will never be the same again. And that is what that is. But the rivers feel different. The land feels different. It was the area of effect is an area the size of Belgium. So it's a huge area. Much of it is fairly impoverished. So there was never extra money. There was never extra of anything. And we lost in Buncombe County, our county, we lost almost half of our mature trees. So that changes everything. And we've been at Mother Grove, we have been raising money, it feels like nonstop for about 7 months. We've kind of backed off for now because we're doing renovations in the temple. But we did a fundraiser specifically to plant native oaks. And we did that between winter solstice and Imolc. And we raised $5,000 that we then gave to a local nonprofit that plants trees. They're called Asheville Greenworks. And I contacted them in December and I said, we have an idea for a fundraiser. We'd like to do it to plant native oaks, and then we would just like to hand you the money so that you can do that. And their development director said, so let me get this straight. You want to raise money and then you just want to give it to us to plant trees. And I said, well, specifically we want to earmark it for native oaks because we lost so many. But yeah, we just want to write you a check. And she said, well, okay, she just sounded so dubious. And then she said, what do you need from us? And I said, I need your permission to use your name while I'm doing the fundraising so that we know where the money's going to go, because we were trying to be very, are still being very careful about that. So we were really happy to be able to write them a check for 5 grand so that they could plant trees. It It was good. And
Yeah.
we've been doing a lot of that sort of thing. If we can't personally do it, because we're not a huge temple, if we can't personally do it, we go out into the community. We're like a nexus for where that stuff can go or where that need is most felt.
That's lovely. Thank you.
Now, we were fortunate, and I will say to anyone who thinks, because I hear from people, oh, that's amazing what you did. We're a small temple, but we have space. So we have three rooms and an old hospital building, and we didn't lose power. So we all kind of gathered here, and then we just jumped into this work. We didn't have any idea that we would do this, but we were positioned to do it, and the call was there, and we just answered the call. And anybody can do this.
Yeah.
Any community can do this. And why it is we don't see more of that, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, let's bring it to some funner, more fun things to talk about.
Larger moment.
So last year you came to Temple Fest, the temple's in-person convention on Labor Day weekend. So what were your highlights about the event or our community?
I love your community so much. And I mean, it all started with Christopher, of course, because he and I would see each other at festivals and conferences. And so I kept an eye on all the things that you all did, which was similar but much larger than what we do. And that gave me a sense of the kinship that we all have. And so when I was invited up there, I was excited to talk to all of you, for one thing, you included. I really wanted to hear more about what you were doing. And just to talk to all the people that were doing the work. And it was so impactful and it was so joyful. So for you to say, let's talk about something a little lighter, it was so joyful and joyous. And okay, I'm going to say the accommodations were great and the food was great. And that goes a long way towards my personal joy. But what I also loved was there was not that sense, which there sometimes is, of this is a closed community, and you as an outsider are being brought in to do your dog and pony show and to answer questions and to sell some books, and then you will go away. I didn't get that sense at all. It was like I came in and people were like, oh, it was like, you're finally here. Great. Oh, I'm so glad you're here. And the classes were really well attended and they went well. And I found out that I have a tiny fan club in Nova Scotia of all places. So, and I love to talk to people about what their communities are doing. So much of my work now is not about magical traditions or technique or practice, because I've been talking about Appalachian folk magic for over a decade, way over a decade. And I feel like I've kind of said all there is to say about that. Plus, I wrote one, two, three and a half books about that. But community building is something that all of us, well, not all of us, a lot of us are stepping into. The kind of community that is your local community, but also the broader sort of in the ether community. And it is so, it's imperative to me to talk to your people about what they're doing, to talk to the people who were visitors to your community, like I am, to find out what you were doing in Ohio, what are you doing in New Jersey, what are you doing in Northern Virginia, for us to really begin to compare notes and to be able to talk about the stuff that worked. And also specifically to talk about the stuff that didn't work. So we poured a lot of money into doing this thing, and it was just a huge bust. I would not recommend doing that. Or we had one person who was so excited about this one aspect of what we do and took leadership on that and brought an entire team together. And we spent almost no money, and we had this incredible effect. So I want to hear all of that. I want to hear the stories. I want to talk about what drives the passion of people, especially pagan and pagan affiliated and earth focused peoples, about what works and what doesn't work. Because far too often we are assuming that the arguments and pissing contests that happen online are the pagan community. And I'm here to say no, that's not us. I don't know who that is, but it's not us.
I feel so this is a saying that I came up with when I was a kid, that a tin can, an empty tin can rings the loudest. But a full tin can doesn't make a sound. So it is really does that make sense? So like sometimes what people get like, oh, I hear this and I hear that, and this is, and I'm like, yeah, that the everyone's gonna talk. That's a human thing. But how are they filling themselves? Like, oh, this is what is the real meat of the work, or vegetable of the work? Who knows? Does that make sense? So like, I love that you found that from our festival and got to talk of two people who are actually doing the work and doing the not just work on themselves, but work for the community as well and giving back.
We have spent many, many years. I mean, face it, we're all weirdos. We're people that if we really fit in to the dominant and dominating culture, we'd be bank managers and whatever all those things are that those people do. But we didn't. And I think that's the reason we can be so creative. We think outside the box because many of us were never allowed inside the box. We were too weird. We were too fat. We wore glasses. We weren't athletes, all those things. And so when we come together, there's a certain amount of healing that each of us has to do when we realize we're with our people, finally, we're with our people. And I think so many communities, and especially the online communities, they're still jockeying for that comfort level. And it comes out in kind of spiteful smartassery. When, if you're on the ground together, there tends to be a little less of that knee, 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 and a little more of I'm doing my personal work, but as a collective, as a community, is there more that we can do? Or I had a dream last night that with five or six other people, we could put together a community garden. And my neighbor said we could use her backyard, and then it kind of unfolds. And I think we're just at the place now where there's a lot of unfolding happening locally that hasn't quite made it into the internet world of whatever it is we are.
So, you talk a lot about our world and our time as tower times. What do you mean by that? And what's your advice for these tower times?
Well, I wrote a book that came out in 2018 called Earthworks, Ceremonies in Tower Time. But I've been talking about tower time since the late 90s. So it's something that I had, and I'll be interested to see if you have these too as a dream person. I also have sometimes waking visions. So I'll be in a place and it's quiet, and I'll focus on a picture on the wall, or I'll focus on a crack in the wall, and then suddenly a vision will unfold. And I love being able to say this to you because that don't sound quite so crazy. But I started having visions of the tarot card, the tower, and I've been reading cards for more than 50 years. So that language is very important to me and very easy for me. So I started thinking about how societies and how cultures collapse and then are reborn in a different way. And I named, and I perceive that we are in that time now, or we're coming into that time. And the danger is that we are so used to hierarchy and to top-down models of governance that it is easy for us to go, oh, the problem is that guy on the top or that gal on the top. Oh, evil incarnate. Once we get rid of that figurehead, then it's all going to be fine. But it isn't, because the problem is not the person at the top of the pyramid. The problem is the structure, because the structure is it is totally supported by this broad cross-section of humans that support a narrower and narrower group of both vision and humanity. And so I kept seeing that this was about to collapse again. And it has collapsed throughout history. The most recent, I guess we could say, is the so-called Age of Enlightenment, when we had the opportunity to do something totally different. And so in our country, the governance structure was structured in a way that felt very, very different from monarchy. But what's happened is that it is turned into oligarchy. And here we are again, just like this. So I kept asking people and talking to people and begging people to look at the possibility that these structures would be collapsing. And we needed to put something in place now before they collapse, because we're so comfortable with them that they collapse. And then we just build them up again and go, oh, see, now it's all better. Look, it's all fine. So I wrote this book, came out in 2018, and I've been Cassandra about this ever since. It's collapsing. I promise you, it's collapsing. And people would go, well, it seems like it's still pretty strong to me. And I would explain, it collapses, it recalibrates, and then it collapses a little bit more. Well, in November, when I woke up to go to the bathroom at 4 o'clock in the morning, which I always do because I'm an old woman and I have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I checked my social media, and Trump had won. And rather than do a long-winded, oh, now everybody ground and center, which I'm really well known for in social media, don't panic, everybody get grounded. I just posted a picture of that book. And it's like, yeah, I told you this was going to happen. I had been telling you this is going to happen for how many years? And some people sort of listened, but we do not have the structures in place right now that we should have had in place. And here we are. And now systems are imploding everywhere. That you cannot name one hierarchical system in this country that functions even remotely like it should. So that's what Tower Time is. And we are in it. And well, actually, we're not in it anymore. I had a strong vision last December, I think. And I announced in social media that Tower Time was over. And we are now in the transition to the star, which is the next card in the tarot. But we are in transition to it. It didn't magically, oh boy, Mercury retrograde is over and now everything's fine. It is a transition because we have got a hell of a mess that we're going to have to clean up. So we need to have our best thinkers imagining how the structure can look in an egalitarian society. And we also have to have engineers figuring out how we physically build on the ruins of this civilization. And I don't know that we have any of that on any real level. Here's your cheery thought for today.
Well, I feel like the part of the star is that, we are all sort of taking on things we might not have thought for ourselves. But our shining light needs to be placed somewhere. We need to pour out the waters both onto the land and the sea and get, that hope back that there is, like just because something's crushed doesn't mean that I lose my hope,
And the thing about the star is that when we think about stars, we think about the Pleiades. We think about all that stuff up in the night sky, which seems so distant. But we also have to remember that there's a star at the center of our solar system. That's a star too. And to find those stars in your community, not because they have a good brand and because they know how to sell whatever tchotchkes they sell, but because when things need to be done, when comfort needs to be spread out upon the waters, that you know who to go to. You know the person in your community that is going to take you by the hand and hold you and give you a hug and help you be the strong one too. And those are stars. And we are, again, we're transitioning into that. We're not there yet, but the world is so full of despair that I think for a lot of people, it's difficult to remember that the stars far away show us what's possible. And the star that's right in the sky right now, heating up the whole damn area, that star is right here and impactful immediately.
So it's sort of like, how can you impact right now, but building towards that distant future?
Yes, exactly. Well said. Well said. I've been doing so much of this encouraging pagans to get involved in their local political scene. And I do have to shout out to some people who at Pagan Unity Fest and also at Summer Magic in Orlando came up to me and said, because I listened to your class last year, I have taken over the leadership of the Democratic Party in my district. I am running for city council. I became a poll worker. Again and again, I'm hearing from people who have the strength and have the vision to step into a woman who's a retired teacher is going to run for the school board, and she's an open pagan. And yes, most of us won't get elected, but some of us will. And the more we are seen as political actors that we care about the Democratic Republic that our ancestors left to us, the more likely we are to be able to affect not only the change from the outside, which has to happen, but also the subtle changes that happen from the inside.
And I feel like people have to consider too that, like, we pagans are part of America. Or well, if you're living in America, if you're not, you know where you are. But we have to be engaged in those things too, and our voice needs to be heard as well. And I think that that's only done by us running and showing that it's a possibility, because history of America, like having like JFK be a Catholic was a big deal, right? Well, that's because other Catholics ran, put that into the consciousness of America. So
Yeah, absolutely.
I feel like we could go on for a long time on that.
Next
So
time, next time.
next time. So you speak a lot about Appalachian magic and folk practices and things like that. How does that folk practice differ from other folk practices?
Well, one of the things I really love is when folk magic practitioners get together because we can share stuff. And it almost always starts out with eggs because eggs are they're like the one truism across all folk magic traditions because they're symbols of life and possibility. So I began, oh gosh, 7 or 8 years ago, I began, oh, sorry, tiny sidestep. In at the beginning of the last century, people came into the Appalachian Mountains. And they heard the ballad singers and the music, and they tracked a lot of that back to the British Isles. They go, "Oh, I know that song. That's Child Ballad 172." So they called themselves song catchers. And I've been tracing Appalachian folk magic back to its some of its roots, and I've been calling myself a spell catcher. So I talk to a lot of different folks. I have, not recently, but I have done a lot of research in the borderlands between Scotland and England, Scotland and Yorkshire. I don't want to get those Yorkshire folks mad at me. In Ireland, I had a wonderful time several years ago with the Deitch folk up in Pennsylvania Dutch country. And we compared what it is we're doing and what we were saving versus the stuff we're just not sure is real. So I do a lot of that. Excuse me. And so there are lots and lots of similarities, but there are also quirky other things. And I tell people, if you think there may have been folk magic in your past, because I can pretty much assure you there was, no matter where you live, that rather than saying to your oldest relatives, so what was that kind of witchy stuff that our family used to do? Because I mean, that might get you smacked, it might get your mouth washed out with soap, all kinds of stuff could happen. It is better to say, hey, grandma, what was that weird kind of superstitious stuff our family used to always do? Like that weird red thread thing that people would wear around their wrist. What was that all about? They love to talk about that because they have a superiority to that. Like, oh no, we don't do that anymore. But now your great great grandfather, he was a water witch and he could douse where the well had to be dug. Or your great great grandmother, now she was a doctor. They called them down here, they called them yarb doctors, cove doctors. But she knew all the herbs to use, and then they'll start trotting out the stories. So language is important. And certainly if you are working with, and I encourage that, if you have the gentleness and temperament to do it, if you are working with Indigenous people and your goal is not to steal their cultural stuff, but to compare cultural stuff, they like that. But don't use the word witch, because yes, we reclaimed that word, but in a vast, vast majority of places, you use that word, and the thought is that you are doing maledictory magic, that you are being bad, 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 and I don't want to have anything to do with you. I worked for many years in a bookstore, and down the shopping center from the bookstore was a Mexican restaurant where we ate at fairly often. And I knew them. And our kids played together on Sundays. And it was lovely. It was lovely. One Halloween, they had this carved styrofoam pumpkin with a witch on a broom. And I went to pay my bill and I went, that's me, Bruja. And it was like the restaurant went silent. And the woman that I knew said, no, not Bruja. Curandera, curandera. And then we talked about the difference between being a healing woman versus being a hexing woman. And of course, in Appalachian folk magic, those two things go hand in hand, but not in that culture. But because we had that conversation afterwards, they referred to me as their brujita. So I would come in to have my lunch, and she would say, Brujita in casa. And then the kitchen staff would wave and I would wave. So it went from being, yikes. And then we had a real conversation out of both of those cultures. And then it could be kind of an inside joke.
I mean, it is hard. I know from my own personal experience, like in college, I took classes in Mesoamerican and, like all the native things and to the Americas. And I remember my professor yelling at me that, no, you know, like if you're a witch, you're, you know, destroying the soul of this person, blah, blah, blah. I was like, no, that's not what I'm talking about. And, you know, his way of sort of speaking of that was either the shaman or the witch doctor, the doctor who took care of you after you'd been hit by a witch. And so it was just figuring out what the words are. And how
And that's
we.
important, but you only get that if you have real conversations.
Instead of knee-jerk reactions.
Yes, exactly.
So, you are a prolific writer. You've written many books. What is your newest book that our listeners could check out?
Oh, my latest that came out in January is called A Feral Church. And that grew out of the death of Carol Christ, Dr. Carol Christ, who I never studied with, but she had a profound effect on me early on. And I felt that it was time for a new book of goddess theology because we hadn't had one in a while. And I put that together, and I put it together in the weirdest possible way. So I write nonfiction, which means there's lots of notes and there's a table of contents and there's this goes in this chapter, this goes in that chapter, and then not with this one. So this one, I would figure out what I wanted to talk about. And then I would figure out the setting for it. And then I would go into meditation, division work. And I would take that whole company because it's a pilgrimage of a group of people through time and space. And we would all go to that place and do it. And then I would come out of the trance and I'd write it down. So it has that dreamy quality to it, but it is all about the rise of the divine feminine, which is, of course, what Mother Grove Goddess Temple exemplifies. But it's also about the welcome from all of the other spiritual and religious traditions who have lost that spark of the divine feminine, or they've covered it over, and to say to them, that Blessed Virgin that you love, she is not only Theotokos, the god bearer, she is in fact a goddess, and to welcome them to think that way. Now, obviously, that goes against thousands of years of tradition and dogma, but for and in that particular instance, so many Catholics pretty much think of her as a goddess. They just don't use the language about that. So if there's trouble, they go right to her and go, Mother, 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 Mater Dolorosa, do I need your help? I need your help. And I think we're going to find that true in all, certainly in the Abrahamic religions, because that Asherah, that is the mother, she is the mother of the Hebrew people, and they have set her aside. And she has lived with that for many and many a long time. But I think this is the time, as these systems are collapsing, when we're going to see the rise of that. And we are seeing it in so many places. Some of the people who blurbed my book were, in fact, Christian ministers who went, oh, yeah, no, I'm with you. Let's do it. Let's do it.
That's awesome.
So, yeah. But my new book that I'm only now working on in my head is going to be about end of life, death and dying, grieving, mourning, all of that. And that is just now in the what the hell am I going to say stages.
I love hearing about your process with your book, because I recently, like, all of my guidance, if you will, it has been about creating the channel of time, of like begin and end are here, and then letting whatever it is flow through me instead of push, 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 which is my usual, you know, manifest it, do this, do that. Instead, I'm allowing something to come through. And I feel like that really resonated to me, and thank you for sharing that. So out of your many books, which one do you think would be, would you, or two, would you recommend for people to get guidance, a little inspiration for these times, maybe practical exercises?
Well, I'll go back to Earthworks, which is all about these collapses. And that is a book in two parts. The beginning is a series of essays about where we are and how we got there and the possibility of things that we can do about it. But the second half is all rituals and ceremonies. Because I think going through a difficult time, if you can slap some ritual on it, if you can ritualize your hardship, then when you get to the other side of it, it feels like, yes, that was ordeal work that I needed to do for some deep manifestation of my inner soul work, or that was a rite of passage, that it was time for me to walk through. And now I've done that and I'm on the other side of that. It gives our everyday experiences a kind of a holy gravitas that elevates it and elevates how we react in it, and then rewards us for the hard work. So I think if people haven't seen that book yet, and I think it's selling pretty well lately, then I encourage that. It's available for order wherever you get your books. And the other book that is my heart book is called Seasons of a Magical Life. And I got to write that book during COVID. And I got to do all the things in the book in the order that they are in the book. So it has a sense of deep reality, maybe. I don't know. But I had concerns, and I still have concerns about a pagan community that claims they love the earth, but they are completely disconnected with the seasons. And you hear people say, I don't know why I even have to celebrate Lammas. It's not even, I don't even eat gluten. What is the point of? Well, the point is that it's the first harvest. And whether you are a farmer and you are actually harvesting, or you are harvesting the seeds that you planted at Immelt, either way, it is metaphoric and symbolic. It doesn't have to be literal. So I wrote this book so that people could understand that the wheel of the year offers you opportunities for your own deepening, but also for doing things with your kids and your family, with your neighbors, with your community. So there's lots of how-tos. There is a section, and my editor laughed and she said, I know why this is here, but I think it's really funny. There's a section on how to boil an egg. So it's Ostara, and you want to boil some eggs. And I said, because I know so many people that don't know how to boil eggs. And she said, yeah, no, me too. So there's a section in it on boiling eggs. There's a section in it on mowing. There's sections on gardening. There's sections on everything. So it's a real hands-on book. And I did it also to honor the Campanellis, who did a couple of those sort of homesteading into paganism sort of books in the 70s, I guess, maybe 80s.
Oh, wow, that's awesome. Well, I hope everyone who's listening goes out and gets those books. That'd be great. So they can know. Now, what in your personal spiritual practice is helping you right now?
Ooh, altar time, altar time. We used to talk about daily spiritual practice. And then I would stretch that a little bit and I'd say regular spiritual practice, because I knew so many people working two jobs, raising kids, doing all the stuff that they really couldn't even sit down at their altar for 10 minutes a day. But find a place where it is a regular practice. I used to say that. Now I say get a daily spiritual practice. It doesn't matter how long it is, doesn't matter if it's in the morning, it doesn't matter if it's at lunchtime, doesn't matter if it's right before you go to bed. Get a daily spiritual practice. You set that. You figure out what that needs to be. But It could be something as simple as you light a candle and you sit with a cup of tea and you drink the tea and you look at the candle and you let things settle around you. It can be as elaborate as lighting all the candles and burning incense and sage in the house, whatever works to get you in the place to remind you that you are connected to spirit, that you don't have to lure spirit in. We already have that. I refer to it as our kinship. All you need to do is acknowledge the kinship because it's right there. Ancestors, spirit folk, gods, whatever dimension we're talking about. But you have to be open to that relationship. You can't be waiting for the divines to sit down in your lap and hand you something. We've got responsibility too. And I've even told some of my people my age, it's like, look, remember when you were a kid and they would make you kneel down beside your bed and say a prayer? Do that. Do that. And you don't have to say, now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul shall keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul. You don't have to say that. Find a quick word, a mantra, some little bit of prayer. And if you can, on your knobbly old knees, get down on your knees. Put your hands in the prayer position and say, "Dear Mother, what a hell of a day. Thanks for getting me through it." Or, "Dear Grandmother, this was a good one. Give me more of those, please. Love you. Thank you. Bye." It's not hard. It's really not hard, but you have to have it into your head to do what your heart needs for you to do.
Thank you. So, where can our listeners find you, your work, and everything about you?
Well, I don't want to find everything about me. I have a website, myvillagerich.com. I am often seen on Facebook. That's my primary social, but also I'm getting better and learning Instagram. At some point, I will be on TikTok, though. I am so apprehensive about that, but I've had so many people, mostly younger people, saying mama or auntie. I'm at the age now where they call me auntie. We need to hear you, because there's just so much stuff that doesn't make any sense, and you always make sense. So soon, TikTok. You can find us wherever podcasts are. We do an Appalachian themed podcast called Weird Mountain Gals, WYRD. And we are coming up on our 300th episode in a couple of weeks. So we've been doing that for a while.
That's
Yeah.
awesome.
And you can see me at festivals. I'm going to be at Mystic South. I'm going to be at Starwood. Yeah, lots of places. I hope to come back to Temple Fest maybe next year. Hint, hint.
Well, from your, mouth into the ears of the people who make those decisions, it's not me. But yes, we would love to have you back, I'm sure. So, let us release our listeners and ourselves and the deities. So we thank the Great Spirit. We thank the two who move as one. We thank the three rays of love, will, and wisdom. We thank the goddess and the god, the lord and the lady who move through us and work with us. May we recognize your presence in our lives. Blessed be. Merry meet, merry part. And marry me again.
Again. Woo-hoo!
You've been listening to Voices of the Temple. The contents of this podcast are copyright 2010 of the Temple of Witchcraft. For more information, please visit templeofwitchcraft.org.